So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
What's he got? Wait, Steamboat's coming back up top. This match is still going on. And Steamboat flies, but he missed it. He missed the flying body press off the top. And now Flair has turned the corner. He twists the leg inside. Wait a minute, inside cradle. Can he hold him? Yes, he can. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat has won the world title.
It was the ultimate counter. Who would have believed it out of nowhere? Small package, no luck. The champion goes down.
Ladies and gentlemen, in 23 minutes and 18 seconds, the winner and new World Heavyweight Champion, Ricky the Dragon.
Welcome, everybody, to Review Away. It is myself, Wei Ting, and joined this week by a very special guest, somebody I love having on this show whenever John Pollock is away. More on that later. But please welcome to the show, Dan the Mouth Labransky.
Hello, hello, everyone. How's it going out there, Wei?
Let's address it. The reason why yes. John Pollock has been away all this time, if you are a follower of his on Facebook, or if you listen to What's Next, you will know the reason.
Yes, okay. John is now a proud papa. It's unbelievable. A 9-pound baby boy. And I really thought it was cool that John and his wife Daniela didn't get it all sussed out in advance. They actually...
completely waited.
Yeah. It's like nobody does that anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was really cool. So 9-pound baby boy, his name's Max William Pollock. And John's totally happy, and he looks totally gorgeous. John sent me some pictures. I'm so happy for both of them, and it sounds like it went well, and the baby's healthy, and it's awesome.
I'm most excited because, I mean, I think a little girl would have been great, but I'm very excited that we potentially have a future reviewer. And not to say, like, if he had a little girl, she wouldn't watch wrestling.
That's right.
But
that's right.
I feel like there might be a bit more of a likely chance that the boy will grow up to be a wrestling fan and hopefully one day take over the mantle.
Yeah.
I'm booking way in advance here.
Are you? You're like old school, like yeah. You've been senior booking title changes a year away.
We're doing a Ric Flair show, and Charlotte, of course, is a big part of.
Yes.
WWE programming right now, but Mouth, I don't think I've done a show with you since the last time we did a review away together,
which was that Super Brawl show. Was it
Super Brawl?
The first Super Brawl.
I don't remember.
The one you and I did.
So people who are keen, I guess, audiophiles may notice a bit of a difference in quality, and that is because we are actually on location at Dan Labransky's house.
Yeah, pretty awesome.
Yeah, this is my first time in your house. I've been to your old place before.
Right. Right.
Which is actually, like, kind of a little famous. It's been profiled and, like...
Now used to have a thing where every week they would profile someone's apartment. Yeah, they did mine at one point.
And, like, you moved here to a bigger space, but it's really just as impressive because your collections are just... very impressive, not just in size, but in how well organized you keep everything. I'm like sitting in front of like a giant stack of like records.
I haven't even shown you the wrestlers in the other room too. Oh,
like that's all, where your wrestling merch
all
is?
The crazy wrestling dolls in the other room.
Man,
yeah.
It really is a collector's dream. So, maybe someday somebody will have a TV show that'll profile this one.
I'm hoping so. Yeah, I'd watch it.
Yeah. So, anyway, How have you been, Mouth?
I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm very good. I've had a great summer so far, doing lots of stuff. My surf band, the Cliff Divers, we've been playing quite a few gigs around town. We got some coming up. We got one coming up in August in the Shameful Tiki here in Toronto, which is an authentic tiki bar.
Mm-hmm.
I love playing there because it just suits us so well. The surf band actually got to play on the beach. We
really?
Played at the Wine and Spirit Festival
about
2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was actually on the beach. So it was amazing. So much fun. Tons of people there. It was great.
I think a lot of our listeners know about your other band, Bruiser Brody.
Of course.
Is a wrestling-themed band of which you are the lead singer, but with your surf band, you're actually the drummer.
That's right. The surf band, there's no vocalist, right? We're just doing all the kind of classic instrumentals that you expect. Surf Rider and, you know, Outer Limits and Batman and all that kind of stuff.
Have there been any, like, surf themes in pro wrestling? Like, have there been any, like, good surf?
Jeez. I'm not sure. You know what? Nothing jumps out at me. They're usually always so, even back to, like, the 80s and 90s, there always seem to be so metal.
Everything is just kind of skewed towards metal.
So metal, especially nowadays, yeah, it's definitely gone in that direction. But no, I don't remember, unless there was, you know, someone that was a surfer gimmick for 2 weeks in WCW at one point or something.
I'm guessing even the bodacious dudes, what a dynamic dudes.
Yeah.
They didn't even have a surf gimmick, eh?
No.
Surfer Sting didn't have a surf gimmick.
Not really. I mean, they pushed that he was from California and from Venice Beach and all that kind of stuff, but not really that he was. You never saw footage of him surfing.
No, he had Metallica.
Like that.
Yeah, he looked like a surfer.
Yeah.
Well, let's just get right into it, because despite this being only 3 matches, there actually is quite a bit to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I decided to choose this series of matches, of course, we were talking about Flair versus Steamboat from 1989, is because there's been so much talk about Omega and Okada having what could end up being the greatest wrestling trilogy of all time.
Right.
Perhaps even a quadrilogy by next year. But I thought it was good enough reason to go back and look at what many consider to currently be the greatest trilogy of all time.
Yeah.
And
I thought, well, I sat down to watch, and I'll get into this as we go through it. It was really interesting to see what kind of similarities there were between both sets of matches, just because, you know, 89, that's so long ago, right? It's in pro wrestling, that's like thousands of years, right?
Like 99 is a long time.
Yeah, like, right.
But the difference between like doing this show, you really realize like how much we evolved, or wrestling had evolved between 89 to 99.
Yeah.
Versus like 99 to 2017. I would say it's not even all that different, right? But 89
true.
To 99
right.
is a world of difference.
It does. They went through a lot of big changes, sure. And so I saw a lot of similarities between what Flair and Steamboat are doing and what Okada and Omega are doing in a lot of their matches. So we'll touch on those as we go through it.
So I was 5 in 1989. So I've never even watched this whole trilogy in full.
Right.
I watched the first match doing a review with John, but I definitely didn't understand the significance at the time watching that match. So I wanted to get you involved on this show because I assume you had been following.
Well, see, actually, it's not like as easy as you might think, though, Wei, because even in 1989, right, we've got no internet. There's no internet or anything like that happening. And at that point in time, TBS, which was the main place, like you would have seen the second match, the Clash of the Champions match, that even didn't really have exposure into Canada, even by that point, by 89. In fact, it wasn't till the next year, 1990, that WCW started to come up to the CNE and just do very, very tiny shows. Like they would, a Rico, actually, it was a smaller building than a Rico style building that they used to come up and do shows. So it wasn't easy for me. You know where I found out about a lot of it was actually in the wrestling magazines, because the magazines at that point were still very much NWA focused. And Vince was almost by that point kind of severed himself. He had the WWF magazine already by that point. And so he kind of separated himself. So the magazines really did focus a lot on the NWA. So that's where I remember first reading about them. And then, you know, so honestly, I didn't see them at the time either. It wasn't until, you know, video started, they would put some of them on video and stuff, and you would be able to rent them. That's where I first saw them.
So what were your kind of recollections of both participants here, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, at around this time? Like, what was your exposure to them?
Oh, well, Steamboat, of course, had the big... Steamboat I had seen a long time because Steamboat was in Mid-Atlantic along with Flair, and that Mid-Atlantic was... in Toronto, like it was Toronto's territory there. It was the territory in place when Vince McMahon came in 1984 and took over and expanded. The Tunnies had broken up with Mid-Atlantic because the Sheik ran the Toronto territory before that, and he kind of just burned it into the ground. It was, he'd kind of really killed it off. So the Tunnies started to work with the Crocketts that and kind of revitalized it. So that's where, because you'd see Steamboat on TV because he was teaming with Youngblood at that point. You saw Flair, Piper, a lot of those guys were all there. So that's where I first saw them. And then, of course, when Vince McMahon did the expansion and he brought Steamboat in and had, of course, like them amazing feuds with like Jake and with Savage, of course, mm-hmm. with the big match at WrestleMania 3. And then shortly after that, he, you know, after he won the title from Savage and there was some problems there with Steamboat, he wanted to take time off. McMahon wouldn't let him, so then he had to quickly lose it to Honky Tonk, and he basically left, and he was out of wrestling for a bit there. And then 1989, he came back, and they knew Flair was there in the NWA, and they knew already, like, well, these guys already have worked together a million times, and they can do something. And I don't think it was a conscious, I could be wrong, I don't know if it was a conscious effort to create a trilogy over a year, or it was just the fact that the matches were getting over so huge that they decided to keep going. I think the whole idea of a trilogy, I think, has been added post-
Sure.
When it happens, you know what I mean? Like, yep. People like to do that kind of stuff, right? I don't think it was consciously conceived as a trilogy.
I wonder how many movies, you know, like, I wonder if the Star Wars... I guess Star Wars.
I don't think it was... there was no way that first movie was conceived to be anything but a movie on its own way. Mm. Absolutely.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't think there would have been any... I don't think he would have been thinking that far ahead that I'm going to make three.
You don't think he would have written all nine? At once?
No.
At some point he did, though. At some point he just sat down and wrote all nine.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just taking from stuff that he did and couldn't use in the other ones. But when that first film did not get a lot of attention right out of the gate, right? And it took some time for it to show and people to start to love it in that. And because it was quite a while before the sequel came out.
Hmm.
It wasn't like it came out right away.
What do you know, or what do you remember of the history between Flair and Steamboat prior to 1989? Like, you mentioned having seen them in Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, it's mostly the Mid-Atlantic stuff, because a lot of the stuff that they did in Mid-Atlantic mm-hmm. was mirrored later in their careers, right?
And were they already kind of known as rivals back then?
Yes, oh, absolutely. They had a feud in Mid-Atlantic. Right. Oh, yeah, the famous quote from Flair, you know, everyone talks to both of them about the 1989 matches, and they have both said in interviews that, you know, yeah, those matches are great, but you know what, there's probably 200 other matches that were better, because those two, I guess, for like Flair says, for almost 5 years they had them working together on and off in matches in Mid-Atlantic. So Flair is very adamant that there are tons of matches that never even got taped or seen outside of the arena that night that he thinks were better than those three. So they had a pretty strong relationship and knew each other's styles inside and out by the time they come to 1989 here.
Let's talk a little bit about just both men on the surface, because first impressions... they both seem to share a lot of similarities, but also a lot of differences. You had Flair here, who was a bleached blonde playboy who personified extravagance and cockiness.
Yeah.
And then you had Steamboat, who played, you know, dark-haired family man, martial artist, who seemed to embody humility and respect. Yet both were very similar in stature and physique, and both used chops as part of their offense. To me, I thought it made for just a perfect visual rivalry just off the bat without even getting into the wrestling.
I think it's a common, it's almost a wrestling template.
Oh, Brett and Sean.
Yeah, exactly.
Ken and Ryu.
Yeah, it is. It's a template, right? And these two could play it to the T. You know, here's the testimony to it, Wei. Steamboat could never, ever turn heel. Mm-hmm. Like, think about that. Mm-hmm. There's, like, no other wrestlers, really, almost hardly any. I'd be super hard-pressed to think of anyone that's just been one, you know? And Steamboat himself even wanted to do it at one point and was talked out of it because they just realized it would not work. Mm. But that to me, that's the testimony how good of a babyface he was. And Flair, you've got one of the best heels, and certainly I would say one of the peak points of his career in 89, right? He's done. Mm-hmm. He's got the gimmick down. You know, it's before. This is right before he leaves to go
to the
WWF, right? Right.
So let's get to the first match. This is February 20th of 1989 at the Chi-Town Rumble. So Ricky Steamboat, disappointed with his IC title run, had left the WWF and then returned to the NWA in January of 1989. He showed up as Eddie Gilbert's surprise tag team partner. Eddie Gilbert was coming off of a feud with Ric Flair at the time. Steamboat showed up as his surprise tag team partner and ended up hitting Flair in a tag team match, which led to him earning this title shot at the Chi-Town Rumble.
And look how simple that is, Way. Very simple. Like, look at how simple that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But now you'll get people pinning the champion in a tag team match, and then you'll also have somebody claiming that they deserve a championship match because they've been undefeated, and then you'll just put everybody into like a multi-person match. So Flair at this point was on his fifth NWA world title run. And he had held the belt for an amazing 452 days. Jim Ross and Magnum TA are calling the matches. How would you assess this version of Jim Ross compared to what he'd later become in the WWF?
Well, actually, I would rather put it in the context of Okada and Omega, if you don't mind, because I'm glad you brought up, because it was something I wanted to bring up. Listening to JR again on these matches, it's absolutely amazing. Like, he's so on his game. His intensity is there. His understanding is there. And he makes guys like Magnum TA and Terry Funk work with him. Like, he's just so good and intense and focused. And I have to admit that those shows in L.A. that just happened, the two New Japan shows in L.A., where him and Josh Barnett did the commentary, I was really disappointed, Way. Mm-hmm.
You're not the only one.
I just felt like... And I know what JR can do, and watching these matches, watching these matches just made me even more angry, because I'm like, JR, I know what you can do, man, and I don't know why he took that laid-back, pun-filled kind of approach. Like, I'm just like, you sound bored to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what it was. I didn't like his call on those matches. And I just think and I understand he is a totally different person, and there's, tons of years in between, decades in between. Mm-hmm. But I was disappointed. And watching these matches again, I was just like, he's so good on all three of these.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of criticism of JR from those shows, and we'll see how well he does in the Mae Young Classic that's coming up. But I think a big part of it is you really kind of got the sense that JR is not a follower of New Japan Pro Wrestling, whereas Flair Steamboat, this seems like something that he knew
and it
very
was
well,
and it was, you know? And it was right.
Same with Austin. You know, he's there every single week, knows those storylines in and out.
Yeah, but still, though, Way, he had done a lot of the Access. Tons of the Access TV, and lots of the stuff that he's done on Access has been good. Mm-hmm. Like, it's had that intensity, and it's added an extra intensity level to the match, which is what he does here. Like, he's so good at keeping up the intensity, right?
I've watched a lot of WWF at this time from 1989 as well, and the contrast to the NWA product is immediate.
It is.
This was presented like a pure sport.
Yes.
Much more sport-like. Ross on the call completely emphasized that with a lot of statistics.
Yes.
It actually felt like an MMA fight.
Right.
You know, like in the way that it was presented. I love this version of Jim Ross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I think a lot of his WWF stuff is good. Don't get me wrong, but he was so controlled in the WWF. Like, a lot of the WWF stuff, you know, that he's got Vince in his ear and people in his ear and stuff like that. And,
yeah, but you know, he was great in that form too, because he was able. He shifted a bit more to more of a, I would say, like a dramatic storyteller. Yeah. This was him kind of really emphasizing wrestling psychology.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm gonna get into the match. You often like to kind of detail every move, but I feel like these matches, because there are only three of them, I think there's so much that's important here in the nuances. I will try my best. So please jump in anytime. Like, there's something you want to comment on. We start off here with Ricky Steamboat. Shoulder tackle, then an immediate pin attempt, which Ross calls surprising. More pin attempts early, and the announcers point out that Steamboat, at this point, doesn't even care about holds. His only interest in the match is to pin Ric Flair and be the world champion. So, immediately, this was a very fast pace to start. It was the fastest of the three matches. Then we get a series of chops from both men, a few hard ones to the chest from Flair, but then Steamboat retaliates with a giant backhand to Ric Flair's face. I'm not sure if he was aiming for his face or if he just like happened to catch him higher, but it got a huge reaction from the crowd. They slow it back down with some chain wrestling. Steamboat with a very simple kind of side headlock sequence.
Very much these first two matches, the opening sequence is lots of headlock.
Lots of headlocks. Yeah. One takeover that actually resulted in a 2.5 count fall, and you could hear this crowd gasp at the kickout.
Oh, yeah. Let me say about the crowd here. They are out of the gate into this match, like right out of the gate. Like they're hot right away, man. And I think it's because, like, it's such a different style of emotional engagement back then than what it's like today. Like, again, to tie this into Okada and Omega, absolutely there's an engagement when you watch it, but I think the engagement is that you're watching two of the top performers putting this thing, like, you're, maybe this is just me, maybe, but you're looking at it, you're analyzing it, and you're watching it more because these are the top guys, and they're gonna pull off an amazing show, and you kind of want to see what they want to see, whereas this match, if you watch that crowd, their emotional engagement is just pure emotional engagement. Like, there's no nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we're watching pro wrestling, these guys are two of the best. It's like that dirty, rotten Flair, Steamboat is up. Like, it's just, it's so amazing, I think, the way that back then, you could still get that proper emotional engagement rather than just people watching because they want to see what they're going to do and they're kind of analyzing it. Whereas this is just like, man, these people are there blowing off steam, having a couple of beers. They want to see Flair get his comeuppance.
In this type of style of match, how much emphasis was there on, I suppose, finishers? Because, like, what surprised me about this sequence, and this took place, like, I would say, like, 2-3 minutes into the match, this audience bought that this side headlock takeover could have ended the match. So much so that they popped, like, when Flair kicked out, like,
yeah. You know,
With like half a second left.
I don't think in cases like that it's really nothing to do with the moves. I just think the emotional engagement is so strong. You got to remember too that, again, Chicago was always part a good wrestling crowd and part of the NWA. They would have known the history probably more in depth as well and stuff like that. But I just find that amazing the way it's so different. Like I don't feel there's that emotional engagement in Omega and Okada like a story. Like you're just watching it because you know they're the top performers and they're going to do a great job, but you don't, I don't know, I guess it's a weird thing. It's a weird dynamic, you know, I feel.
You don't sense as much of the kind of relatability to the characters? Is that what
Yeah, I just mean? Don't feel that it's, the crowd is getting, is engaging themselves with a story or anything. Like people going, oh, that dirty, rotten Flair, and I want to see him get beat by Ricky Steamboat. It's not like, oh, that dirty Omega, I want to see him get beat by Okada.
No, in fact, most of us are cheering for Omega, at least on this side of the
world. Well, and that's funny, too, because if you notice, in some of this, it might be the final match, but the crowd cheers for Flair. Yeah. The crowd gets a lot. Flair gets a lot of cheers.
All right, so, you know, back in the ring, actually, after a few more pin attempts, Flair retreats to the floor for a second, and again, seems to want to slow the pace down. Flair continues to go out to the outside just to kind of reset himself because Steamboat keeps getting the better of him. Magnum TA points out how Flair has already felt Steamboat pinning him in that tag match, and so it's psychologically affecting him in this one. Did you like Magnum TA on the call here?
I honestly thought he was okay.
I thought he was good,
too. I really did. Yeah. I thought there was no one that was... I guess it's funny, he's got a different partner on every match.
Yes, he does, yeah.
It doesn't bother me. I thought, especially Funk, I just thought Funk was fantastic in terms of giving you the feeling, like the way MMA commentators tell you about moves and things and what they're trying to do when you particularly might not be able to know or might not be able to tell. Mm-hmm. I thought Funk did a great job of that, and I always liked Bob Caudle. I thought he was great, but yeah, I thought Magnum was good here, too.
Steamboat with a very explosive style, lots of quick movement, head scissors, takeovers, arm drags, chops, and again, Flair has to reset himself by going to the floor. Momentum clearly on the side of Steamboat for this match. It shifts when Flair pulls Steamboat out to the floor with him. He rakes the eye, slams Steamboat into the guardrail, basically plays dirty in order to even the odds with Steamboat's athleticism. Steamboat gets a brief comeback, Irish whips Flair into the corner. Flair flip, runs the apron top rope. This time, Flair actually nails a high cross onto Steamboat, but it's unsuccessful as Steamboat reverses his momentum into a pin attempt for two. Ross and the audience already at this point are going nuts at these near falls. With the crowd at a high, Flair hits an inverted atomic drop, applies his first figure four. The crowd is already standing, chanting, Steamboat, Steamboat. Flair is using the ropes for leverage, but referee Tommy Young catches him, forces him to break it up.
Like, see what I mean? Like, just that whole sequence you just described, crowds on their feet, yelling for Steamboat. I just don't see that in an Okada Omega match if one of them was in trouble like that, you know?
Ross himself is his dial is elevated, I'd say, to about an 8 out of 10 at this point. So Flair's on the attack. A pin attempt is bridged out by Steamboat and transitioned into a double arm suplex. And I just, to me, the visual of Steamboat bridging out from under his pin, I thought was a great way to begin Steamboat's comeback. Because have you seen Spider-Man yet?
Not the new one. No, I'm totally pumped.
Whatever. Okay, this is no spoilers at all. But like, so often you see the hero at his worst, and a physical feat of having to lift something is a great way to kind of transition into his comeback. And, you know, I thought Steamboat bridging out of this pin attempt played that for me.
Right.
So the early part of this match was really fast, but the slow pace of the comeback, the slowed down pin attempts, really highlighted how much of a struggle it was for Steamboat to keep on fighting in the latter portion of this match.
And that's Flair. I was just reading an interview with Steamboat the other day where he talked about how Flair was so good at gauging crowd reaction and knowing exactly when to slow down, speed up the matches. Mm-hmm. So that would be Flair. You know, he probably wouldn't even say anything to Steamboat. He'd probably just roll out of the ring and Steamboat would go, okay, we're going to slow things down a bit now. Like, just so good at reading a crowd.
Steamboat dives off the top with the judo chop. Ross is at a 9.5 now. Steamboat is seemingly about to win the title, hits a diving crossbody, but in the process, he nails referee Tommy Young. So with the referee down, for some reason, they give Flair a visionary fall with Flair hooking the tights. And
yeah, which really makes no sense with a ref bump,
to me, it didn't make that much sense. But we get to the finish. The ref is down. Steamboat again misses a flying crossbody. Ric Flair attempts a figure four, but Steamboat reverses this into an inside cradle, and referee Teddy Long runs
in. He's come down to check on the other ref, yeah.
He runs in, makes the cover, and Ric Flair's 452-day reign ends in 23 minutes and 18 seconds with Ricky Steamboat's first world title victory.
Yeah, excellent match. You know, the crowd goes crazy, and you know, really, really, really clever booking, too, you know. Really, really clever. Bringing Steamboat back as someone that the fans know, but they haven't seen in a long time, and put him in a pro, and then have him beat the champion like that. But it's huge.
Do you think it was surprising? You know.
Yes. I bet you it was, because back in those days, they did so much to keep. Well, look at you said over a year.
Yeah.
He had the title over a year, right? Mm-hmm. And they so many times would book Flair to win and DQ finishes and things where the fans got screwed and stuff like that. So, oh yeah, I think they might have just probably thought this is going to go on forever. I think because they let it go so long, when they finally pulled the trigger, the fans went crazy.
So in an interview with WWE.com, which I encourage everybody to read as a supplement to this review, Steamboat states that the fast-paced nature of the match was by design. He said he had a similar mentality as he did here with the Savage
match. That's right. He wanted it to be the same style.
Where all the near falls and false finishes were because his character's mindset was to simply win the championship. So, no, you know, not as much of an emphasis on holds in this one.
Right.
And it was just a lot of Steamboat going for pins early on.
Yeah. I read that interview, too. It's very good.
Up next, our second match. So, at this point, I mean, this match receives a lot of accolades. And now, much like Okada and Omega after Wrestle Kingdom, the two of them had to follow it up with at least an equal performance, if not better.
Yes.
So, we go to April 2nd of 1989 in New Orleans, Louisiana, at Clash of the Champions 6 for a 2-out-of-3-falls match between Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair. this show went up directly against WrestleMania 5 on paper.
That is exactly it. Yes, that's exactly right.
And that was, of course, Savage versus Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim Ross calls this one again, but this time he's with Terry Funk, and Terry Funk is even wearing a suit for the occasion.
Yeah, again, this is someone like Steamboat that had been away for a while. Right, and this was their way of slowly kind of bringing him back into the mix.
They were saying Funk was out making movies?
Yes. This is when he did all the movies with Stallone, like Over the Top and Thunder Alley, I think it's called. He did a bunch. He had a good run there for a little while where he went off, and this was him coming back. So this was their way of kind of integrating Flair into the mix. Now, I don't know if it was planned, like what happens at the end of the third match, but it was obvious that they were using this as a way to integrate Funk back into the product.
Interesting. All right, so this match starts off. It's a 2 out of 3 falls match, and so you can expect the pace to be a bit slower than the previous one. They start off with a bit of amateur wrestling.
I liked that. Yeah. I liked that. One of the things I liked, I just thought because the first one started with all the headlocks and stuff, I thought that was really cool the way they started off like that. Because it's really hard when you have two performers and you're doing a series of matches to keep things fresh, right? Like when I talked, we did the interview with Kenny Omega at the ROH show, he talked about how hard that is and how you have to think about your approach. Because if you look at all three of these matches with Flair and Steamboat, there are spots that are in all three.
Yes, definitely. They're definite callbacks.
You know, there's stuff. But at the same time, there's also stuff that's not in other matches as well. And I think that's the same with Omega and Okada. I would see that as a similarity here because they're, I think, very good at that. Mm-hmm. They have their standard things that they want to try to do as well, but like work a body part. But they'll also come up with some new stuff that that you haven't seen before, which, you know, is always essential.
Flair shoves Steamboat, and Steamboat slaps Flair hard in the face, really kind of setting the animosity between the two of them. They have an intense stare down, and immediately you sense the pacing of this one is going to be a little bit slower. Much of the first fall is Steamboat using headlocks and front face locks with some faster offense peppered in between. Crowd really into it. And I found it interesting because when I think of the whole recent dive debate with like Randy Orton and Rip Rogers, I feel like this is probably the template of the exact type of match guys like Orton aspire to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they say slow it down in the WWE kind of mentality.
Yeah. Well, and Orton loves to do the headlocks, right?
Yeah.
He's really the only guy in the modern era that uses them extensively.
But
right?
My question is, you know, for you, do you think a match like this would garner a similar reaction today? Is that even a fair comparison? You know,
you think this match, if it was on, a WWE pay-per-view today?
Yeah.
Boy, I would, you know what? I'd like to be the optimist and believe that it would.
Obviously, it has a lot to do with kind of how over the characters are.
Yes.
But let's say the two most over, Joe versus Brock.
Right, okay.
If they did a headlock series like Flair and Steamboat did, do you think it'd be just as hot?
Yeah, because, well, I think with Joe and Lesnar it would be because I think you've got the power of two huge guys. I think a headlock, when it's used by guys of that size, I think, yeah, I do. I think you could.
Hmm.
I mean, they'd have to work, but I think so. I think I buy that more than I buy Randy Orton using it. You know what I mean?
I'll also say in this case, it definitely helps when you have Jim Ross make constant mention of headlocks having an effect on Flair's balance. Which
right.
really is essentially what a headlock is supposed to do. It's supposed to kind of
disorient you.
Apply pressure to the ears and the temple. It's not just a rest hold. It's supposed to have a purpose. But I think so many, you know, we all kind of just look at headlocks as, oh, they're just chilling.
They're having a rest. Yeah, it's their chance to rest.
But before the match gets too slow, these two decide to speed it up with some rope running, resulting in some pinning combinations. Steamboat dives for a splash, but Flair gets his knees up, and this shifts the momentum towards Ric Flair. Our first fall comes as Ric Flair applies the figure four, and just like their first match, Steamboat reverses into a small package, but this time, Flair has the move scouted, flipping Steamboat over into his own small package for the pinfall at 1933.
Yeah, I really liked that.
Yeah.
I really liked the way it went back to the first match.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, this is really clever. It's almost the same thing, but the other guy gets the advantage and gets the pin. I thought, wow, so smart.
Well, you get the impression that Flair baited Steamboat into doing the small package.
That's right, so that you got this the first time, yeah. It's so clever, and that's the little nuances when you're doing a series that makes a series work, right?
And I wonder, I'm assuming Jim Ross Gargano himself probably didn't have really any communication about the layout of the match beforehand.
He probably knew the finish.
Yeah, right? But like I feel like that's something the announcers could have really like effectively like made mention of. Instead, it kind of leaves it up to the viewer.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. Well, yeah, which means they probably weren't told, mm-hmm. right?
So now that Ricky Steamboat is behind, Steamboat starts off a little bit faster, wrestling with a bit more urgency. Flair lands a knee drop, but Steamboat avoids a second. Steamboat begins to repeatedly drop elbows on Ric Flair's left leg. He did like 30 of them.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that's almost a criticism, I thought, because I know I really expected that Flair would sell it more in the match. Because Steamboat did so many. Like, for that era, for someone to do that many was really kind of, you didn't see that. And I really thought Flair would have sold it a little bit more, just because it was so, like you said, it seemed like 30 in a row.
He does all this to set up a figure four of his own, Ricky Steamboat does. But this time Ric Flair grabs the ropes. There's another sequence. And
That's another thing that I love in these matches. I think when you have two guys that know each other really well, you have to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And again, another similarity between Okada and Omega, where they're doing each other's moves, mm-hmm. right? And
do you see that a lot more now?
Yeah.
You
know? I like that. I like that. I think it adds to the drama.
You see it so much that it's... Yeah, I don't have a problem with it at all. But you see it so much that it's actually a feature in a video game where you can steal your opponent.
Is that right?
You could steal your opponent's finisher.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Is that right, eh? I like it. I mean, I they made great use of it here, and I think Okada and Omega have really made great use of that too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, using each other's moves.
So another sequence this time ends with Steamboat catching a Boston Crab onto Flair, and I got the sense that, you know, because they did so many headlocks in the majority of the matches, the figure four and the Boston Crab both felt a lot more important.
Yes.
Yet for the performers, they're not really expelling that much more energy.
That's the brilliance of so much of this way, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, the old school guys don't like about the young kids today, is that way that they're accomplishing so much by doing so mm-hmm. little. Mm-hmm. Like, I think some of these old guys, it used to be almost like a badge of honor to do a match where they did as little as possible yet drove the crowd friggin' crazy.
No, well, I mean, that's kind of Randy's argument the entire
time. Yeah, yeah.
With this whole thing. Action spills to the floor, and this time again, using the barricades as a weapon, Flair gains the advantage. Flair attempts multiple pins with his feet on the ropes. The crowd starts yelling at the ref to pay attention, but Flair turns around and tells them to just shut up.
He's so great. I always loved, especially when I got to see it live, when he would pick someone in the crowd and he would go after that person. I just thought, you have to be so thinking on your feet to spot that person, know what to say. And I love the way, because it really disappeared for a long time. I love the way Kevin Owens has brought that back in pro wrestling.
Yelling at the crowd.
It's that emotional engagement. You have to engage the crowd. When I was a little kid, Wayne, and I was going to my first wrestling matches in small arena in Simcoe, that was the best. As a little kid, if you could get the wrestler to look at you, to yell at you, you know.
For me, I
lived for that kind of stuff.
For me, I think it's like, it's not just the yelling at the crowd, but I think just the idea of being able to improvise in general.
Yes.
You know, that I feel like maybe new performers coming up feel afraid because the WWE is such a big managed
and control,
production.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, you also...
But you notice, though, that now that Owens has many guys,
yes.
like it's almost like it opened the floodgates.
If they're confident enough to do it.
Yeah.
You know? You get the sense that like Bully Ray would do it a lot, like the veterans would do it a lot, but you get the sense that like a lot of the newer people don't really know how to do it.
I just, ever since Owen started doing it again, I seem to see so many more guys kind of realizing, yeah, we should do that.
Mm. So Ric Flair goes to the top, Steamboat chases him down, lands a big superplex onto Flair, and Ross makes mention of Flair's injured back from the plane crash.
Yep, I love the way he brings up real... See, that's what was so great back then. You had your work story, but that's real history. Mm-hmm. That's real. That happened.
Yeah. I mean, this was a Flair-Steamboat trilogy, but I think equally as impressive as the two of them was Jim Ross in these matches.
Yes,
We go to the finish here, where Steamboat... with Flair's injured back and injured, I guess, head from the headlocks, applies an elevated double chicken wing, and with the accumulation of wear on his body, Ric Flair submits.
And this is huge. This is huge, and Ross brings it up. Flair had never submitted to anything, right? Like that. This was a huge thing for this to happen, for him to submit like that. Because usually, if it would have happened, you would think they would have done a pinfall. Like, I was so surprised they did.
Yeah, that were submissions that much more rare back then?
Oh yes, very much so. Yeah, it was mostly always pinfalls.
And why do you think that is, and why do you think that's changed? Like, why were submissions not as popular? Well, I mean, Flair had the figure four, so people would always have.
But, I mean, there were some of them, but really, if I think of so many of the guys from when I was younger, mostly all of their moves were a set move that led to just a pinfall. Like, yeah.
But for a champion of the caliber of Ric Flair to submit, I guess...
It's huge. That's huge, right?
Everybody always saw submitting as sort of like a weaker...
Mm-hmm. It's weaker than a pinfall, I think, right? It seemed... Because you kind of... You have to literally give up. A pinfall, you're beaten, kind of, right? You have to literally give up in a submission.
We go to our third fall now, and they take commercial breaks between the pinfalls. But we get back from commercial break, and Ric Flair still has trouble standing from the double chicken wing. He wrestles an early part of this match even on his knees. A couple times he does try to get back up. He Flair flops multiple times back onto the floor. Flair starts to target Steamboat's left leg for the figure four. And Steamboat charges Flair into the corner with a running knee. Flair moves out of the way, and Steamboat catches his own left leg over the top rope. Flair continues to work on it. Finally applies to the figure four. Steamboat is in this one for a very long time.
And I wanted to comment on Steamboat's selling. Because he, like, for that spot, like, he was in that figure four a long time. And for that spot to work, man, his selling is essential. And his selling was just absolutely fantastic. Like, you genuinely, by this guy is in a ton of pain right now. He doesn't know what to do. He can't even think straight. He doesn't know how to combat it. Can he turn him over? You know, I always thought one of Steamboat's strongest traits, and a great trait, a babyface to have, selling. His selling was just friggin' off the charts. I mean, some people thought he oversold, but I never really thought he oversold. I thought he was great.
Steamboat is in the figure four. He swings for momentum and is able to finally reach the ropes. They get into their near falls. Flair hits a crossbody for two. Steamboat, with his own high cross, gets two. And then Steamboat hits a reverse neckbreaker finally for two. They're at 54 minutes now in this match with a 60-minute time limit. Funk is already calling this match of the year ahead of their Chi-Town Rumble match. Flair goes to the top. He's body slammed again. Steamboat goes again for his elevated double chicken wing, which earned him the second fall. It looks like he's attempting to bridge Flair over into a tiger suplex. Either that...
No, I think the idea is his knee gave out.
He collapsed, right, okay.
Yeah, the idea was that his knee gave out, and Flair fell... He fell backwards with Flair, and Flair's on top of him, and the referee sees Steamboat's shoulders down, so he counts.
So, this to me looked a little bit awkward on first watch, because not only were Flair's shoulders down, but Steamboat's shoulders were also down. In fact, it looked more like Flair was pinning Steamboat to me.
Well, yeah, that's the idea. Flair is pinning Steamboat.
But the ref was counting Flair's...
Counting Steamboat's...
Wait, but the three... So anyway, this results in a count of three, and the referee raises Ricky Steamboat's hand.
Right.
So the ref was actually counting Ric Flair's shoulders on the ground. So to me, I was a little confused watching this. But when you watch it again, you do see Steamboat raise his own shoulder.
Oh, that's right, that he raised it just at the last minute there.
Yeah. There was a bit of a delayed reaction here because I got the sense the crowd also wasn't necessarily sure who won that pinfall.
Yeah, it was tricky too because Flair had his foot under the rope as well, right?
Which I think was supposed to play into the controversy of the match.
Yeah.
That to me was kind of the only real weird, messy part of an otherwise pretty flawless 55-minute match.
Yeah, long match, really long match. Yeah.
Some consider this to be their best match of the trilogy. But that's all subjective.
You know what my thing is, Way? Honestly, when people say what was your best, it's what's their favorite of your Flair Steamboat matches, it's usually the one I just watched.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like last night, I was doing the same thing last night when I was getting ready for this. I'm like, oh, yeah, that Clash match is great. But you know what? I watched the one we're going to talk about next, and then I went, you know what? That's the best one. Mm. It's so hard.
I thought the storytelling in detail in this one was incredible.
Yeah.
All the foreshadowing and the callbacks to their previous finishes I thought were really brilliant. Steamboat in that interview says this was his favorite of the trilogy, and Flair says he didn't think it was that good. He points out the crowd cheering for him too much in this one as the reason for not liking this one as much.
Which they did. They did.
So, and maybe that played into the finish of the next match.
Right.
So, stemming from the controversial finish of this one, with Flair's foot under the rope, we head into Wrestle War 89. With Flair having lost two straight to Steamboat. And, when you're following, like, magazines and stuff, like, did you get a sense of, like, that, hey, these two are like, you know, having some really great matches?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Because they would, I mean, they'd have the pictures and stuff. But, yeah, you'd read the articles. A lot of times, when it was stuff, articles like that, like, a lot of times in the wrestling mags, the writers would just make the articles up when it came to stuff like angles. But when they're actually recounting a match, they would recount the match.
Right.
And I'd read them and just... It's, you know, I'd read them and go, wow, this sounds friggin' amazing, mm-hmm. right? It's same as when I would first get the Wrestling Observer by Dave, and I would get them and I would read all the Japanese TV reports, and I'd be like, that's what got me into Japanese wrestling. I'm like, I have to see these matches, because the reports he would write of the matches, you'd be just like, that sounds fantastic. I have to see that, right? Mm. And the same with ones like this.
I think, like, you're probably seeing that now, but in a more... kind of immediate sense with
message, well, exactly. Then wait, I had to go find a Japanese video store here. I had to find a place here in Toronto where the guy was getting the tapes from Japan. The guy was getting the tapes from Japan, and he would. I'd have to go rent the, and they would be like 6 months behind. But I would still go, and as soon as they come in, I would rent them. And
now you either go on New Japan World or you just Google it,
and or you watch it live.
Yeah,
you watch it live. Yeah. Like the fact that I can watch. Like last, you know, a couple weeks ago when we did the show and Jay watched Slammiversary and I watched the second show from California, I'm mm-hmm. like, I was sitting there going, I'm watching this live. Mm-hmm. I cannot believe that I'm getting to watch a New Japan match of this caliber and, just live. It was mm-hmm. unbelievable. I would never thought that would have ever happened.
So we head into our third and final match of the trilogy. This is Wrestle War Music City Showdown in Nashville, Tennessee.
Of course, it's in Nashville.
May 7th of 1989. So we're probably, a month removed from the last one?
They're all very close together. Yeah. They're all within like 2 or 3 months of mm-hmm. each other.
February to May 7th of 1989.
Yeah.
This is billed as Ric Flair's last chance at Ricky Steamboat's title. There are three judges sitting ringside to ensure that there are no controversial finishes and that if there's a draw, that they will decide a winner. If Flair comes out... Or Ric Flair does come out. He comes out in a flashy robe and a bunch of girls with him. Steamboat walks out with his wife and his son Richie wearing an Elvis outfit riding a pony.
Yeah.
Quite the contrast.
Yes, yes.
Gary Michael Capetta introduces us to the three judges, and they are Lou Thesz, Pat O'Connor, and Terry Funk.
Which is a pretty esteemed panel. If you know your wrestling history, that's a pretty esteemed panel of guys.
I found it interesting.
Like, that to me, like, again, something missing from today. Like, because of those guys' history, like, that adds a huge amount of credibility to the match. Yeah. Having legendary guys there to be judges, to fans back then that were longtime fans, that would have been huge to have those guys there.
Well, Thesz himself was holding a record at this time of having 6 world championship wins, correct?
Yes,
And Flair was actually going for the 6 in match. That's so right. I found that interesting. The announcers are Jim Ross and this time Bob Caudle. Do you have any thoughts on
Caudle? I always liked Bob Caudle. He was, Mid-Atlantic was bought, like, I instantly think of Bob Caudle when I think of Mid-Atlantic, because him and Crockett used to do a lot of the commentary, and I always thought Bob Caudle did a great job. He got the points across. He was good with the talent, like when he'd have to do the stand-up interviews with the other, he was always good. I liked him. I mean, he wasn't the most flashiest, exciting guy, but I thought he was good.
Start the match. These two exchange some really, really hard chops to each other. Steamboat's maybe even a bit more aggressive than Flair's. And then a test of strength is won by Ricky Steamboat, who begins this time to work on Ric Flair's arm.
Yeah, and I like that because we'd had the two previous matches start with a lot of headlock work and stuff like that, and this time, and apparently that same WWE interview says that Flair didn't want to do the arm drags.
Yeah.
He was not a, I don't think he liked having to hit the mat that hard when Steamboat would do those arm drags, right?
Yeah.
So he Steamboat had wanted to do it before this match, and Flair had always talked him out of it. So.
Really, what's so interesting in neither of the previous two matches, you didn't see any arm drag.
No, and that was a huge Steamboat thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was, you know, that's like almost is that right up there with the chop with Flair. Yeah. Like he was always about the arm drag.
But this one was essentially built around all the work on the arm and the arm drags,
and
because the headlocks they felt like they had done too many.
It was they needed to switch it up.
Steamboat starts chaining hammerlocks with arm bars and repeated knees to the arm of Flair, and Jim Ross reminds us that Ricky Steamboat's work on Flair's arms may lead directly to the double chicken wing, which he obviously submitted Flair with in the last match. I think Ross does a great job in the match here anatomically describing Steamboat's the damage of a hammerlock onto the arm or an armbar onto the arm.
Well, because they're very simplistic things to look at. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's great because the average Joe might think, well, what do you mean? He's just kind of got his arm behind his back. Mm-hmm. Well, him explaining it to you and telling you where the pressure points are and all that kind of stuff, it gets it across.
Unfortunately, I feel like that type of, like, commentary might be a little bit tougher these days because we watch MMA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that what an actual armbar looks
right.
like versus, you know, a pro wrestling
sure.
armbar. So it's a little tougher for, let's say, even somebody like Jim Ross to get away with like
right.
that type of analysis.
That's fair. Yes, that's fair.
But, you know, I'm sure there's a way around it. I haven't really watched much of New Japan World, but I'm sure like somebody like a Josh Barnett would be somebody
who'd
be able to perfectly kind of
And he does do that. He is good at doing like what Funk did in the last match and explaining to you how things work and right. what it's doing and why they're doing it.
So we go here 15 minutes in, and we learn that we get updated judges' scorecards every
this part I thought, I don't know. I'm like, I like the idea that the judges are just there if it goes to a draw and we have to figure something out. I thought that was a bit silly with updates from the judges. I don't do that in boxing and
stuff.
You
prefer Pride rules to the UFC rules where they go round by round.
This was
UFC rules where they basically score, like... I guess you give scores out each time a judge hands a scorecard. And in the first 15 minutes, all three judges decide to award a point to Ricky Steamboat.
Yes.
And if at the end, and it's a draw, the number of points that you've accumulated
earns
you
that victory. Determine the winner,
So Ricky Steamboat charges at Ric Flair. Oh, it's kind of like the TNA Grand Champion.
I was just thinking the same thing, too. It's somewhat similar.
So Ricky Steamboat...
It's not actual rounds, but...
Ricky Steamboat charges at Ric Flair, but Ric Flair throws Steamboat over the top rope to the floor. Steamboat, anytime he's in the floor, just doesn't seem to have the have luck on his side because Flair.
But again, I love those things. Like that's what it's so simple. But look at the reaction.
The
you
heel
know?
Will obviously do better in the kind of unfair environment.
Yeah, and I love too though. But again, talking about the emotional engagement, there's a spot in this one where I don't know if it's this particular part, but where Steamboat gets thrown to the outside, and he's just kind of trying to get his act together. And the fans, because the railing around the fans, it's just a piece of like metal. You can there's nothing. It's not solid.
Guardrail. Yeah.
Yeah, and fans are literally pushing. Fans are literally pushing Steamboat, trying to help him get back towards the ring. I'm just like, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. You don't think Roman would get that treatment?
I don't.
Oh.
I don't.
All right, so Steamboat is chopped over the barricade where, as Mel said, the fans cheer him on. Steamboat regains his strength and charges back at Flair into the ring. And Flair flip in the corner. Steamboat catches him with a chop down to the apron, back to the armbar from Ricky Steamboat. Steamboat dives at Flair, but Flair moves out of the way, sending Steamboat again to the floor. Back in the ring, belly-to-back suplex from Flair gets a very close near fall, and we get our next set of scorecards. And we learn that Funk decides to go with Ric Flair because of that near fall.
Mm-hmm.
I like that reasoning.
Yeah.
Pat O'Connor also gives the quote-unquote round to Ric Flair, but Luthez gives it to Steamboat. So Steamboat is ahead on the scorecards 4-2 in this match. Flair goes up top. Steamboat catches him, throws him down, and they get to their near falls. The crowd is really hot by now. Steamboat gets a superplex, and then Steamboat attempts his first double chicken wing. but Flair is too close to the ropes, so that's broken up. Steamboat goes up to the top, but Flair runs into the ropes to take away his balance, and Steamboat falls to the floor, clutching his leg. Flair sees Steamboat with his injured leg and applies the figure four. Steamboat fights out of it, hits an enziguri, and then the finish comes, with Steamboat going for a body slam, but Flair reverses into an inside cradle, rolls Steamboat up to win his sixth World Heavyweight Championship.
Yeah, amazing. Another thing I wanted to mention, just out of the... Whenever they're outside in the crowd in this match, again, because of the time period, and because the guardrail itself is so minimalist, there's this real dangerousness. There's this real sense of danger.
Metal.
In the matches. And just, yeah, them getting thrown into the metal and getting through, actually being in the crowd with the people, because it was so rare that stuff like that happened back then. Mm-hmm. And I just got, it's just... You know, thanks to ECW and hardcore and everything, it's just so common now. Even, you know, the way it's filtered into New Japan, where you see way more stuff on the outside. When I first started watching New Japan, you never saw stuff like that on the outside, right? Mm-hmm. Unless it was someone crazy like Bruiser Brody or Abdullah or Hansen or something. And now it's very, very common. And it's just, I guess, because back then you didn't see it as much, and that super flimsy barrier, it felt much more dangerous. You know?
Like, we're talking about an era where, like, throwing somebody over the top rope was controversial.
That's right. It would be a DQ sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Any other thoughts on this match, which you consider their favorite of?
That's just because I watched it today. Right. Like, it really is good. Like, you mm-hmm. know, unbelievable storytelling. And it is too bad that some of their matches from when they were in their youth in Mid-Atlantic don't survive. Because mm-hmm. I can bet... If they're saying that, they might be exaggerating that there were 200 or whatever, but I'll bet you there was a good friggin' dozen of them. Like, it would just be, and think of it, they're both really young. I'm sure there would have been
Flair at this point was 41, but still probably.
This was at a point way where they were almost trying to get rid of. Mm. In fact, that's why Flair ends up going to the WWF shortly after this, because a lot of those guys in charge thought he was done. They thought he was done at this point way.
He's having matches like this.
They thought he was done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy.
The post-match, just as significant as anything in the match, Steamboat is hobbling on one leg and raises Flair's arm as he leaves the ring. Jim Ross gets in the ring, interviews Ric Flair. Ric Flair says Ricky Steamboat is the greatest champion that he's ever faced. Terry Funk comes in, says he wants to congratulate Ric, and says that if it had gone 60, Funk would have voted for Ric Flair. Jim Ross wants to continue the interview, but Funk just still won't leave. He's still hovering over Ric. Funk says he wants to challenge Flair for the belt. Flair says he's honored, but Funk hasn't been active being in Hollywood, and there's a list of top 10 challengers waiting for him. Was there an actual ranking system?
They actually did them. I mean, they weren't consistent, but they did. They did put the illusion forth that there was an actual list of contenders. The old wrestling mags would always have the list of contenders and stuff like that.
And like with the NWA and all the territories actually respect that ranking?
Yeah, at the time, for a while, yes. For a while they did, yeah. Hmm.
So Funk thinks Flair is calling him not good enough to be in the top 10, and then they argue a little. Funk ultimately says, "I was just kidding," offers to shake Ric Flair's hand, but then decks him, and he attacks Ric Flair. He just snaps.
It's great. It's classic Terry Funk.
Attacks Ric Flair through the ringside area in his suit. Funk even pile drives Ric Flair onto the judges' table.
And again, I'm going to tell you, 1989 way, no one was getting friggin' pile driven through a table.
Yeah.
That was huge. I remember seeing just the pictures, the still photos in the magazines, thinking, holy fuck, man, he put him through a table. I'm like, it was just unheard of way, like unheard of, even for someone. And this is before Funk's even got that hardcore image he'd later get in ECW. This you can almost point to this as the beginning of the hardcore of Terry Funk, because it was just such a big deal at the time. And you see, the thing is, though, you had to do something incredibly drastic because you want Flair to be your babyface here. Mm-hmm. And like, okay, it's got to be really bad then to make the change that Flair's going to be a babyface. So, you know, that was just Punk, you know, putting him through the table was just huge.
Yeah, so, I mean, this was clearly designed, like you said, to turn Ric Flair babyface. But the crowd seemingly already wanted to cheer for him. Right?
That is true. When he wins the title back here, there's a lot of cheering going on as well. It's almost half and half.
And I'm guessing it was just a level of respect that the audience started to build up for.
It is. Like any good performer, the people just start to love you, right?
Mm-hmm. What was notable here was that Ricky Steamboat says he had no idea this was about to happen. In fact, Steamboat thought that they were going to go into a fourth match, expected to get back his title. So when he was walking up the ramp and saw all this craziness with Funk and Flair in the ring, he said he felt quite disappointed because he knew it was the end of his feud with Flair.
Yeah.
And he said that he felt like he was stabbed in the back by the promotion, and it left a sour taste in his mouth for years. So that was kind of shitty.
Mm-hmm.
Steamboat says that he thought this was a great match, but the least favorite of the three for him. And goes on to again say what Ric Flair has said, that the two of them have had many more better matches.
The fact that both of them say that means they're made, I mean, it's just, it's one of those sad things that they just, those, some of those matches were never recorded in any way, because I'm sure they were fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the other thing too, just as a footnote, the match he ends up having with Funk, leading out of this angle, was actually really good, too.
The Flair Funk match.
Yeah.
Mm, interesting. All right, well, that kind of finishes the actual review of the matches themselves. Do you have any, like, closing thoughts on the match?
No, just that thank you for picking this way. So I had to actually had a legit reason to watch these matches again. Like, it was like, I'm like, because, you know, it's so hard now, because with the show and stuff, I have to watch a lot of wrestling every week, and my wrestling card's pretty
Believe
well filled.
Me, with John away, like, I usually have to watch a lot of wrestling, but this time, like, having to take detailed notes, I don't know how that man does it every single week. I've been driven crazy.
Yeah, so. Me too, yeah. And it's like, even, we have to watch so much that there's no real stuff where I can kick back and go, okay, I'm just going to enjoy an old match, or I'm going to enjoy something else, and it's very hard. So it was nice to have you have to watch all three Flair Steamboat matches.
I forced him to do it.
Yeah, it was good. No, it was fun to revisit those matches, because they are awesome.
So let's get into some feedback, and I think there are some questions here that I hope you can join me in answering. We go to McWhalen, who says, every wrestling fan knows it as the trilogy, and it lives up to the hype. Flair Steamboat is the wrestling equivalent to Ali Frazier in boxing. The only event in wrestling that has captivated fans more is the rise of Southpaw Regional Wrestling. Just kidding, Mouth. All three matches are great and would win Match of the Year honors individually if they were fought in separate years. The first match is amazing. The second match has been deemed by some as the best match in North America ever. And the third match is a fast-paced classic and the best cap-off for a wrestling series of matches ever. One thing that needs to be said. Even though many say that the second match is the best of the three, it was the least viewed since Booker George Scott refused to promote the Clash match out of fear the house shows would suffer. Needless to say, he was fired right after this happened. Flair has said that there are even better matches the two had together on house shows. Personally, of the three, I like the first one the best, but each of the matches is required viewing for any hardcore wrestling fan.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure.
Our next piece of feedback says, I originally became aware of this trilogy via the Ultimate Ric Flair Collection, which had the last two matches on it. I didn't watch the Chi-Town Rumble match until it was on the Rise and Fall of WCW. I've always heard that the second and third were regarded as the better of the three, both receiving 5 stars from Dave Meltzer. I think all three received 5 stars from Dave.
I was just wondering, too, did one of them win Match of the Year? I can't remember who won Match of the Year in 89.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume so, but I think all three were rated 5 stars. And there's a lot of debate about which one is actually better. For me personally, I preferred the first over the second, but the final one is my absolute favorite. All three are absolutely incredible, and it really depends on the day as to which...
See, there you go. I told you. It's like the last one I watched is usually the one I think's the best.
He says, I just didn't like the finish all too much in the second. I liked the first one mainly for the shock of Steamboat actually winning, and the last because it summed up everything they had done in a great package. It also turned Flair face in the process, but that could have also been Funk beating the piss out of him after. Speaking of, we have to give credit to Jim Ross, who called these matches so well. Really highlights why he's the greatest of all time on commentary.
He, you know, if you're not familiar with his stuff before WWF, man, like, because that's where I first saw him, was in the NWA and WCW stuff, and I instantly was just like, wow. And that was the whole appeal to me, because WWE, by the late 80s, it's starting to get really, really cartoony, and it's just starting to get really annoying as Vince is trying to create gimmicks on guys, and they're just failing and they're not working. And up here in Canada, you didn't have really a lot because Vince had such strong control up here, and the one WCW show ended up started to be syndicated, and you had to, you know, it was on Saturday nights at friggin' midnight, and, you know, this is, again, before VCRs and that, but I would search it out constantly, and I would watch it, and I would watch an Arn Anderson match, and I'd be like, wow, this is so different, and I like this so much more.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why New Japan is so hot and so successful right now is because they are presenting
such a sport-like presentation
of pro wrestling. They're giving you that, yeah. Do you think there'd be a lot of fans of New Japan currently who'd be also fans of this incarnation of like NWA?
I would think so. Yeah, I would think so. Definitely. You got to remember, a lot of these guys were working in Japan at that time too, right? Flair did that set with Fujinami in Japan and stuff like that. So
he says, "I want to end a question for you guys. Do you think the Okada Omega trilogy could be seen as better than this? It's already had two outstanding matches, and the third coming up in the G1 has high expectations. I also have you guys watched the Punk Joe trilogy from ROH, and what do you think of that?"
Ah, geez, it's been a long time. I did see the Punk Joe trilogy. Too. Yeah, it's, I mean, there was, you know.
They're very different, you know? Like, they're different styles, but I do remember the crowd being amazing for those matches as well. These debates really, like, you can argue forever. It depends on your preference. Yeah, what type of wrestling do you like? Who did you grow up with? Who do you have a better, more emotional attachment to?
What type of product, you know, exactly. If you grew up in Attitude Era, a lot of people like that type of crash and burn type of thing, right? If you grew up me, I'm older. I like a different thing, right?
You're also like comparing, you know, a match featuring a heavy emphasis on a headlock series versus, you know, Okada Omega, not to say they're doing anything that crazy, but like, you know, like moonsaults into the crowd, reverse
but those
Rana's.
Spots, they pick and choose their spots,
yes,
though.
Do,
again,
yeah.
Like Flair and Steamboat, if you're going to, you know, they do those spots where they both tumble over the top rope to the floor, and it means a big deal because there's very few of them. I find that with Okada and Omega, that they're, I said that to Kenny Omega, he's like so good. He's so good at just having a couple of them in the match, and then they really mean a lot more, right?
But to compare matches from 2017 to 1989, you kind of have to either grade them on a scale or like do what Dave's done and essentially just kind of rate the current one one star higher. And that's not because Flair and Steamboat wasn't the best, but it's just because
it's evolution. It's evolution, man. Yeah. It's evolution. And to answer that part, Okada Omega totally could become the biggest trilogy of all time, better than Flair and Steamboat. Absolutely. Are you kidding? Absolutely. I could totally see it happening because those first two matches have just been so outstanding. Great storytelling. And, you know, I talked about Steamboat selling. Okada sells like, I don't know, man. Like, his selling is just fantastic. You buy, and you see the pain on the guy's face. Like, he does an amazing job.
Up next, we go to Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Can't wait for your review of this. Sure, hardcore fans may know Flair and Steamboat faced each other countless times in the late 70s for the NWA US title, but this is the trilogy that made them legends, in my opinion. Nowadays, programs work so fast that the same people are facing each other all the time. But back then, you had to wait for the story to unfold.
Yes. And that's a big part of it, too. It really is. That anticipation. The fact that you didn't get to see a big match every week on television, right?
It really has a lot more similarities to MMA than maybe the current version of pro wrestling. He says, nowadays programs... the promos, the TV segments, etc., and the arc that started with Flair as a heel and ended with him as a respecting babyface, top-notch. Jesse from the Six is our final piece of feedback. He says, interesting choice of review. Of course, the three matches are exceptional, but I wonder about the storylines in NWA and WCW. Perhaps Mouth can shed some light on this. My understanding was that the company was grooming Sting as the next big star to take over for Flair, and that's why they didn't put the title on Luger and instead had him lose to Flair at Starrcade 88. So, why did they decide to put the title on Steamboat almost immediately upon his return to NWA and WCW? And how did they decide to go from this feud to having a face Flair defend the title against the heel Terry Funk?
That's a good question. I know they were grooming Sting. They probably felt he wasn't quite ready yet at this point.
In fact, on one of the matches, Ross was talking about how Sting was supposed to defend the U.S. title.
That's
and,
right.
And they would get to it if That's there was right. enough time in the broadcast.
Yeah, that was on the 2 out of 3 falls one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. On the Clash one. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that obviously was the plan to go with Sting. I don't think he was quite ready. Yeah, I think going with Steamboat was just because he hadn't been around and he was known to that fan base. And I thought it was, you know, it's a genuine way to kind of mix things up a little bit, you know, and of course, and I think it was always probably planned to be a short reign so they could keep building up Flair's runs as well. But that was the plan, for it to put it on Sting, and then Flair would kind of be put out to pasture, and he wasn't having that. And that's when he went to WWF and had his run there, and then came back and was on top for another 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is it. Thank you, Mouth, for joining.
Hey, no problem.
I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was good.
I love, much like you, you know, I didn't grow up with this stuff, but, like, I love going back and analyzing it and studying it. I had always heard about these matches, but, you know, never really had an excuse because I watched so much wrestling already to go back. And, like, you know, when I do these shows with John, like, it gives me a new perspective when I watch the new stuff to go back and watch this old
stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think anything is, if you're into, and you know this about me, Way, that if I'm into anything, mm-hmm. I want to know the history. Whether it's music, television, movies, comic books, pro wrestling, I'm always really interested in the history and where did it come from and mm-hmm. what was it like before and what were the changes. So, yeah, I think it's always great to go back and watch this stuff.
In 2 weeks' time, John Pollock will be back on the show, and he and I will be reviewing the Kevin Owens DVD that just recently
came out. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I watched the little half-hour teaser on the network and really liked it.
Yeah.
Like, really liked it. Like, I'm like, I totally want to see the whole thing.
Yeah, I think people can tell, like, when I'm in charge of the choices, I like to pick things that I actually want to watch versus, like,
sure.
when the audience chooses for us.
Yeah, yeah, like, right.
They're
right.
always something
Heroes
bad.
Of wrestling.
So I'm sorry, like, when I'm picking another good thing this week.
No, I'm really pumped. I thought the teaser thing was great. Hearing from his parents and just from him mm-hmm. and, you know, Zane, and the fact that they got all the great old footage, like, they didn't fool around, you know.
We may or may not have a guest reviewer on that one, but tune in for that. John, now that people know the news, John, we'd like to give him another week off so that he could spend time with his
wife. Oh, that's big of you, Way.
Yeah, well, I'm nice like that. So, coming up on Monday and Tuesday, I'll have Court Bauer joining me for review.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
And I'll have Alex Greenfield joining me for review
of
SmackDown.
Excellent. Yeah.
So, you guys won't miss a thing. And where can people find the Mouth? Online, on social media. Where are you? What are you
doing? Well, you know, I have no Instagram, no Twitter.
You got to get on that. You know, John got on Instagram.
I'm on Facebook. Yeah. I mean, my girlfriend is on Instagram, and you guys are all on her Instagram, so I get to see all your stuff.
Maybe you need to get a cell phone first before you
get on Instagram. Let's not push things here. I'm still listening to records, Way. Let's not push things here.
But Mouth is on Facebook if for people who
Yeah, you can send me a friend. If you're a Law fan, please tell me that when you send your friend request, because I won't if I just see a generic friend request and I don't know who it is. But if they all they have to say is, like, hey, Mouth, fan of the Law, I'm into that.
Chad Old Wrestling with him. And what about the Cliff Divers? Where can people find out about the
Cliff Divers? The Cliff Divers have an awesome Facebook page as well. And also there's a site called Reverb Nation, which we have some music up. You can actually listen to clips. And there's stuff on YouTube as well. You can just do a search for the Cliff Divers on YouTube. A friend of mine put together a nice little video for us at a show a little while ago. So you can check that out. And
awesome.
Yeah.
And check for Dan on the Law every Sunday. This week, what are you guys doing?
This week it's kind of a break, right? Last couple of weeks been busy, right? Because we had the double shot of Slammiversary and the second New Japan show. And then the last week we just had Great Balls of Fire.
I believe this week you guys have an interview with Justin Roberts.
Oh, that's right. Yes, John got a copy of his new book, which I'm also very excited to read. I think that will be a good one. And he did get to read it, and he's talked to Justin Roberts. That's right. But it's a lull in the pay-per-view scene. We get a break this week, and then Battleground is the next week after.
Mm-hmm.
It's at that point now where there's almost a pay-per-view every weekend.
Yeah, yeah. It's very crazy. Exciting. Thank you for joining me, Mouth. You can follow me at Way0937. Follow at Law Radio, blah, blah, blah. What sauce? Okay.
So did you finish your coffee? Now you can actually have a beer with me.
We'll see. We'll see. I'm certainly feeling the fatigue.
That's right, you were saying my
body's not really holding up all that well.
Well, you did great. Thank you very much.
It's a lot of wrestling to watch on top of my.
And you took pretty crazy notes there. Yeah.
I need to do that. Yeah. Otherwise, like, you know, to really kind of absorb the match. But that in between, John does a lot of work, and I'm definitely realizing that.
Yeah,
you know, it takes a lot to fill in for him. But maybe I'll take you up on it. What song should we go out with, Mel?
Oh man.
What do you think represents this feud?
Just because they're one of my all-time favorite bands, and their new album is just friggin' fantastic. Hawkwind, that's called Into the Woods. They've been around since, like, you know, 1969, and they've had ups and downs in their entire career, and they're really experiencing a bit of a resurgence now, believe it or not, in 2017. This album and the one before it have both been like a return to form, really good, sci-fi oriented rock and roll with a lot of themes and ideas that are relevant in society today, you know. Their last album called The Machine, I think it was called The Machine Stops, was based on a novel from 1909 about people in the future just all in little cocoons with screens in front of them. In 1909,
Wayne. Well, that's us.
That's what I mean. That's us right now. It was written in 1909.
Wow. Amazing.
I'm like, that's 100 years ago.
Is this the first? Some Hawkwind on Review Away?
Probably. Probably yes. Although I've made you listen to it in your car before.
You have, yes. Here we go, Hawkwind. See ya.